from WXXI News and broadcasting live from our WEOS studios at Finger Lakes Public Radio in Geneva, I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome to Connections. It's always good to be in our WEOS studios here. And want to go back to 1973 for our connection this hour. The first induction of the National Women's Hall of Fame. It will not come as a surprise to you that that first class of inductees to the Women's Hall of Fame included Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But did you know that there were 20 in that first class? And now it's a biannual thing where the recent class, the 2017 induction, just happened. And you might have had a chance to hear briefly some of those inductees, but this hour, a wonderful opportunity to hear a couple of inductees, one of them at length, and we're going to hear more about the women who were inducted, the process, and the future of the National Women's Hall of Fame, because if you've been following it for over the decades, you know that, well, the hall currently housed now in the Helen Mosher Barbin Building in the heart of downtown, the historic district there, Seneca Falls, but they've got big plans on where they want to go next. Let me go ahead and welcome the co-presidents of the National Women's Hall of Fame. Betty Bayer is here. She is also a professor of women's studies here at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Betty, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Evan. I'm very happy to be here. It's an honor to have the opportunity to talk about the hall.
It's been a great conversation this hour and so many remarkable women to talk about. Eileen Hartman is also a co-president. She's also been heavily involved in the American Association of University Women, or AAUW for short. Eileen, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Evan, and for this great opportunity to be here and talk about the National Women's Hall of Fame.
I want to let our listeners know that the website is really well put together on this. So if you happen to be listening at work or maybe listening to a podcast later and you want to spend some time and sit down and look up these women, let's talk about this. A lot of the women on the list are some names that you've heard, but some names that you go, well, I didn't make that connection. I didn't know that. So go to womenofthehall.org for all the information there. And my guess also, listeners, is you know where the hall is, but you've probably still never been there, and it's open 7 days a week. So there's a great chance for you to visit. Later this hour, we'll talk a little bit more about this, but Betty, you guys are aiming to eventually have a new home for the hall eventually, yes?
We are. We're well on our way to getting into that new home, or we like to think that way about it. It's the 1844 Seneca Knitting Mill. It's in Seneca Falls. It's been on the National Historical Registry since 1991, and we have received a number of grants, and we've stabilized the building. We've put in over 100 new historically accurate windows, and we're excited about moving into the first floor in 2018, and then we hope to have the whole building by 2020.
And it's still going to take some community contribution to get there, is that correct?
It's going to take a lot of contributions to get there. We'll be launching our capital campaign in October, and we're asking people to join in. There are lots of ways if you're interested in naming opportunities. There are naming opportunities. There are ways to give monthly. There are ways, large or small, to join the project.
All right, again, it's womenofthehall.org online, and before the hour is up, we'll circle back to that, because that is a big, ambitious project and a very important development for the hall's future. So, but let's talk a little bit about how women are inducted. First of all, Betty, Eileen, how many women are in the Hall of Fame now?
There are, counting this weekend's additional 10, there are 276 who are honored by the National Women's Hall of Fame, currently pictured in the hall itself, and of course online.
And you should know, this is not an annual thing. This is, so the next class will be 2019. You're already taking nominations?
On the website, you will find an application form and the instructions and the qualifications, all the instructions you need, and to know also that the nomination deadline for 2019's induction is January 31st of 2018.
Oh, okay. So only a few months of time.
That's,
and then you've
right,
got
right.
You've got a long process to make those considerations. Can you tell us roughly how many nominations? Obviously, you're not going to tell us names that didn't make the cut, but can you roughly give us a sense of how many women get nominated?
Yes, I can give you an example. For the 2017 inductees, 10 women were selected from over 200 nominations. The nominations come from the public at large, so we invite all people to nominate. And each nomination goes out to four or five judges. So no one who is employed by the hall or on the board is involved in the process.
Independent judges.
Independent judges, experts related to the fields of the women who are nominated. There are two main criteria. One is that it must transform the landscape of America, the contribution. And the second is it must do so in enduring ways. So they're sorted and ranked, and a list is then presented to an independent induction committee. Eileen and I didn't know the finalist names until just a couple of days before we announced as co-presidents. So it's a very careful process because it is a public museum. And so the public nominates, and we have a group of public experts selected based on the nominees to adjudicate.
Can I
about
ask
30?
Oh, I'm
about,
sorry.
About 30 or so judges.
Or more, yeah.
Or more who help us out with that every year.
And so can I ask both of you what that's like when you finally get to see the list, given the fact that you know this evaluation's going on, but you don't know which women are going to be on the list until those final days. Betty, what's that like for you to see that list?
Well, you can bribe all you want. I kept saying, hey, we have to prepare. How will we prepare to make the announcement in 2 days? But, you know, they stand by that. So it's a huge excitement. And there's a lot that you learn in the process as a co-president or when you're involved with the board, because you are digging into the histories of women as well. And as you mentioned earlier, sometimes they're women we know, and I teach in women's history, and sometimes they're not. And that's the beauty of the public nominations.
What about you, Eileen? What is that like for you?
Very exciting. And also, I just wanted to point out that there is a great deal of teamwork involved in it, too. We have co-chairs for the induction ceremony who are very involved in making sure the press is aware of who they are. It's very exciting to be able to stand at the podium and announce to the public through the press who these women are and give the brief explanations at that point of what they have achieved, why they're being honored, and get the information out and get it rolling and get the excitement building to get us to the induction ceremony.
Eileen and Betty, I mentioned that a lot of our listeners will know where the hall is, but still, just based on the numbers, have probably not ever visited. You're open 7 days a week. What do you want the public to know about coming out to see you?
Well, that we are open 7 days a week, that we welcome some of the public who comes and falls in love with the hall. Sometimes they want to become volunteers, and we're open to that as well. It's 76 Fall Street in Seneca Falls. Take your time. People come back. We have had visitors from all over the globe, and that's the fascinating part, that international tours come through, local people come through. This summer, we had a woman who came to celebrate her 90th birthday at the hall and just spend some time with the biographies. And it's a very powerful experience to be in a room with, well, now 276 biographies of women, when our textbooks tell us so little about how women have created and invented and made so many parts of American life.
I was going to ask you something, and I think I want to ask it in a different way. I was going to ask you how often you see mothers with their daughters, but I also want to ask you how often you see parents with their sons and that value.
Absolutely. And I love, whether it's daughters or sons, moms or dads, to see the aha moments when they go and they read something about a woman that they had no reference point to in the past, but that may relate to them specifically in whatever their interests are, their studies are, and how they can make those connections between what they personally feel, what their skills are. It's just that aha moment where they go, oh, I had no idea that that person did that, or how did they mesh what it was that their life was about, and then pursue specific areas in their careers, their involvement, their philanthropy. So it's those wonderful personal moments that I especially like.
And I'll ask, as I get ready to ask Betty that same question, I'll ask producer Megan Mack across the table. My mind goes to something that I just saw a tweet yesterday. So Wendy Zukerman is the host of a podcast called Science Versus, and she tweeted something yesterday. Some really powerful historic warrior, they were doing some excavation, and one of the big announcements was it turned out to be A woman.
Yes.
Did you hear the story?
I just saw it briefly, I actually got a printout for my class this afternoon.
So Megan will help us find that. But in the meantime, Betty, for you as well, I'm sure you see mothers with their daughters, grandmothers with their granddaughters. But I think it's also important not just to sort of pigeonhole that and say, how wonderful is it to see sons and young boys out there and understanding and internalizing those lessons?
Oh, absolutely. That's been a huge part and always central to the entire women's movement, because the liberation of women is also the liberation of men. I mean, that's just been a bottom, you know, sort of a foundational point. But the other thing is that, you know, Matilda Cuomo was nominated by a man as an inductee. So, you know, men are nominating women to the hall as well as inductees, and they are, you know, volunteers. We have men on our board. So, yes, we are a nonpartisan, open participation group. So, you could give that.
Let me just say here, here's the headline that I was thinking of. A 10th century warrior. Oh, you found it as well. Okay, so here we go. How many warrior women are missing from the history books? There's the Guardian headline. And a 10th century warrior Viking buried with a sword, an axe, a spear, a knife, shields, and war horses, DNA proves, was a woman.
Yes.
And Wendy just wrote, she tweets, ooh, and she's got all caps, women. So,
yes.
You know, I don't know why history wouldn't allow women to be sort of considered in that way, but DNA is showing us that, yes, women were powerful warriors too.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Betty.
We've had many of those warriors nominated and honored them in a variety of categories, so we continue to need to point out how critical it is to make sure that the world knows about these women achievers.
Well, we have a wonderful chance to hear Amy Mullins, especially at length, Temple Grandin, who has been on this program in the past. But I will tell our listeners now, in our second half hour, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the other inductees who we didn't get a chance to interview from the 2017 class. And if you want to join the program, maybe you have questions about, you know, women throughout history. Are they in the Hall of Fame? Or if they're not in the Hall of Fame, how can I nominate them? If you want to call the program, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. If you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Betty Bayer and Eileen Hartman are co-presidents of the National Women's Hall of Fame. They just had their 2017 induction weekend. 10 more women inducted into the hall. womenofthehall.org. The first conversation I want to have a chance to listen to. Our colleague Beth Adams had a chance to talk to Amy Mullins, and just for sake of Morning Edition, which Beth hosts, had to kind of edit that interview down. And some of our listeners were saying, boy, that was so great. You know, I'd love to hear more. Well, you have a chance to hear more now. You get to hear the interview in full. And why don't I briefly have Betty and Eileen remind our listeners who Amy Mullins is before we listen to that conversation.
Sure.
So I did some additional research on Amy Mullins and wrote up the biography as Betty and I split up the 10 women to do the in-depth look at them and write-ups on them. She was born without shin bones, and at the age of one had her legs amputated below the knee. She then became an outstanding academic person through her elementary, high school level, and on into college. She went to Georgetown University, won an academic scholarship to go there, and turned to track and field, which led her to approach the coach there, and eventually was winning all kinds of medals and Division I competitions on the track, and came up with the idea of using cheetah legs in order that would allow her to run swiftly and win those competitions. She then also became a model because she realized how important it was to other women and girls and everyone that somebody could achieve what she had done, and how important image is. And she used her role as a model then to forward that idea, And then she became a designer. I skipped over the fact also that when she was at Georgetown, she was, I believe, the youngest woman to ever become an intelligence analyst at the Pentagon.
I think it's 17 or 18 years old.
Clearance, yes.
Amazing.
So it was amazing. So she's a woman of also has a wonderful sense of humor that we noted when she was at the induction ceremony this weekend and at the podium spoke a little bit about how she felt at first that she didn't quite understand how somebody as young as she was could be inducted into the Women's Hall of Fame. And so she told some very funny and personal stories about her friends responding to her being nominated, the fact that she was nominated for this honor. So she's a delightful and very accomplished young woman.
Well, let's listen to the conversation of inductee of the 2017 class, Amy Mullins, with our own Beth Adams.
You've been breaking through barriers, obviously, throughout your life. Have you ever considered gender a barrier?
Sure. I mean, in my current endeavor, which is acting, it's something that I think every woman feels, for sure. I mean, the moment you turn 29, you're getting offered sort of grandmother roles. And you think I'm kidding, I'm not. It is extraordinary just how there's just these... I was listening to the audiobook of Tina Fey's Bossy Pants the other day while my husband and I were plastering a room. And, you know, she addresses this a lot, just being in her in Second City in Chicago with improv and then saying, we can't have three out of the six cast members be women because there just won't be enough parts to go around. She's like, but we're making it up. It's improv. We're making up the scenes. How could you say that? So I think there is something ingrained, certainly, and I have experienced it, but not to the same egregious effect that I've experienced just an innate discrimination against what people perceive as disability.
Yeah, in one of your TED Talks, in fact, you make a brilliant case for how disability really isn't a disability at all. It can be the opposite. It can be an asset. Would you tell that story briefly about how you got a room full of children to see your prosthesis as this beautiful thing?
Sure. Well, it was, you know, partially based on the way that I grew up as a child in the 80s and 90s, and I was surrounded with pop culture. You know, we had the Terminator, where you saw this robot with articulated ankles and knees, and RoboCop, and, you know, it's been going into sort of Avatar and this new life on the internet with something like Second Life, where people were creating avatars and realizing that this feeling that I'd had, which is, why does this have to be some onus, some heavy onus, like, oh, we have to replace this missing part of her limb, and the best we can do is this horrible rubberized foot and this horrible wooden leg. So fast forward, taking, you know, going to people who were Hollywood special effects, prosthetic makeup artists and wax museum designers and jewelry designers and fashion designers and, you know, people who didn't have the baggage of what a prosthetic should be, designing prosthetics. And I was asked to speak to a group of kids who are around about 8 years old, which is the most terrifying audience ever. You know,
yeah.
you're sort of octogenarians and you're the under eight crowd, and for the exact same reason. They have no edit button. They will say exactly what they think, and they're usually right. So, you know, I thought, oh man, show and tell. That's how I have to do this, is just engage them physically. And it was at the Children's Museum in Boston. So I thought the tactile approach would be best. And you hear the teachers and the administrators trying to figure out ways to make this group of, you know, 7 and 8 year olds subdued and polite and, you know, and actually not curious, which is against human nature. And so I had brought all this bag of different legs, and I was in the auditorium alone, and I had a table in front of me on the stage, and I had laid out all these different legs, and I heard the head wrangling administrator say to these kids, listen, kids, listen to me. Whatever you do, just please don't stare at her legs. I overheard this, and I thought, no, that's exactly the point. Don't inculcate these children that there's something to be avoided here, that there's something wrong with me, especially when I've come to share these stories about all the different kinds of legs I've been able to have built for me and try out and be the guinea pig for. So I made a deal with these teachers to give me 2 minutes alone with the kids before any adults came in. And so when the kids came in, they just descended on this table. And they did what kids do when there's this tactile thing in front of them. They touched it and they were, you know, trying to put all their weight on the sprinting leg to see if they could bounce on it. And, you know, they were tickling my toes of the silicone feet that look incredibly, you know, like flesh and bone, and seeing if I had a reaction standing 10 feet away and, you know, smelling them to see if the feet smelled bad. And everything. And I said, kids, just quickly, imagine that you could build any legs you wanted for me. And I want to just be able to jump over a house, just 2 stories, maybe 3 stories, but, you know, just jump over a house. What kind of legs would you build me? And immediately some kid goes, it should be a kangaroo. And someone else, it should be a frog. And someone said, it should be Go-Go Gadget. And then some kid went, wait, why wouldn't you want to fly too? Why would you just want to jump? And all the kids went, yeah. And I was like, yeah, yes, of course. Of course I want to fly too. Look at me limiting myself to something as banal as just jumping over a house. And it was so immediate. I mean, this happened in under 2 minutes. That if I hadn't tried to prevent these kids looking at me, being trained to look at me as someone who was disabled, less than, less capable than them, they wouldn't have had this self, you know, this discovery on their own of going, we can make her body go much further, and she could even possibly be super abled and be able to do things that our flesh and bone legs can't do yet. And that's where I found this extremely thrilling paradigm shift happening in society is that, and we're seeing it now across the board with, you know, more gender fluidity and people really asking to have more autonomy over their identity and to have the power to change it as their life goes on.
It's pretty evident that you have this powerful sense of self-motivation, and it was there very early in your life. Where does that come from?
Oh, I don't know. He said it was evident that it was there early. That's for sure. I mean, I'm not a parent yet, but I'm now at the age where my friends are starting to have children, and everyone says it's kind of wild. These kids come out, their personalities are almost fully formed. They have a drive, or they are reticent to engage with the world, or some of these things are really innate. But I also think, you know, I believe that your environment and how you're treated in these formative years is very important. And the truth is, my parents, you know, my dad's an immigrant from Ireland. My mom is one of 11 kids. And, you know, they had bigger problems on their plate than worrying about if I was going to be made fun of at school, if I was being stared at all the time, which I was. And it was very much on me to develop a sense of self that was strong enough to withstand that kind of scrutiny and mockery and, you know, the kind of humiliation that is generally only reserved for puberty. But in my life, it started a lot earlier. And that formed a resilience in me. And I was always headstrong. I was always very stubborn, very determined, and always had a very healthy sense of naivete, of complete possibility. And that's the quality that I struggle to hold on to now, where I still absolutely believe that I can play parts. Like Hollywood can see me in roles to play parts of women that don't have prosthetic legs. And it is the hardest battle I have fought, but it's happening.
Is that why you decided also to get into fashion modeling?
Well, fashion modeling was, you know, that was a kind of a weird detour. I certainly never, it wasn't anything I'd ever wanted to do as a little girl. I was a gawky, awkward-looking child pretty much after the age of 7. That was the truth. I was probably cute as a toddler and then not, really not. And yet, you know, I had spent so much time in hospital as a kid that I learned how powerful my imagination was, and I could completely reimagine myself. And oftentimes I would be men in my daydreams. Or if I was women, they were very, very powerful women. They were always leaders and, you know, people who could sort of command de facto armies. And it's something that I know, like I said, it's always been there, but it has to be honed and tested. And as far as I was concerned, when I first became exposed to the world of design. You know, I spoke at my first TED conference. I think I had graduated college like that week. So I was 20, barely 21, if that. And, you know, there I was sitting with Frank Gehry and all these incredible people and looking, being trained to look at objects that in a way I hadn't before. And people were coming up to me saying, you know, you're really beautiful. You don't look disabled. And I thought, that's so amazing because I don't feel disabled. And also, I guarantee you that the pinup calendar you have on your garage wall has more, these women have more prosthetic in their body than I do. And Photoshop. I mean, it's this idea that you shave off part of a nose and it's enhancement, or you put a prosthetic in a breast cavity, it's augmentation, but you shave off part of a limb and you put a prosthetic, it's disability. And that's where the idea of taking a medium like fashion, which is has so much frivolous, you know, frivolity in it, and yet has a very powerful reach and an impact, I thought it could be a great forum to talk about this. Like, what does a sexy body have to look like? And what is beauty, and what's a powerful image?
What does it mean to you, Amy, to be inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame? You've had so many accomplishments and accolades throughout your life. Does this feel different?
It does, Beth. I'm not going to lie. I'm kind of nervous. And I'm kind of freaked out. When I got the news, I was actually sitting in a chair getting my hair cut. And this woman has known me for nearly 15 years. And I was like, I don't know if I'm reading this right. Is that right? Am I being asked to come, like, present an award to an inductee? Or I think I'm being inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. And she went, "Well, you're so young." And I said, there's a feeling, certainly for me, what it's done is it's really galvanized me to have the same fire and chutzpah. And like I said, genuine naivete, like I can do this. I can do anything if I set my mind to it, which is a wonderful naivete. And most people have it beaten out of them just because of life. And it has galvanized me to continue to go forth and push on doors that are closed to me until they open, or until I find someone who helps me carve out a new door.
What's next for you? And in fact, you mentioned being young. May I ask how old you are now?
I just turned 42.
So at 42, you're in the National Women's Hall of Fame. You've been an actor. You've been a model. Your TED Talks are among the most listened to and viewed in the world, I think. So what's next? What do you want to conquer next?
Well, I wouldn't say that I've conquered the acting world at all, but, you know, it's great. You know, I just was in, I played a funny character part on a comedy that apparently aired last night. I woke up to a bunch of text messages about it because it's...
What's it called?
Oh, it's a show called Odd Mom Out on Bravo. And,
oh, yeah.
And it was, you know, like I said, at least I am actually getting to do it. I'm playing women. I'm playing characters that don't have prosthetic legs. So that is my, you know, my real goal. We see actors all the time who in real life don't have any kind of a physical or emotional or intellectual disability, and they play characters who do. But we rarely get to see the opposite, if at all. And so that's something that's still... I'm still chipping away at, but it's, you know, it's definitely getting there. And also I'm starting to produce. So I am going to be producing my first feature film next spring, which is a huge responsibility that I felt myself gulp when I actually said it out loud, but that's happening. And I'm excited. You know, I'm excited when I think about how many, you know, right now we are in this golden age of television, and there's so many platforms now that want original content. And you do see people who are smart and curious and passionate about storytelling being given opportunities that just weren't there even 10 years ago. So I think it's a really exciting time. And I'm also excited that some of my peer groups are now starting to be able to have some power in this industry. And you're getting to see some really young, I mean, I'm on a show called Stranger Things, and the creators and the writers and directors, they're twins who are like 32, I think. The Duffer Brothers. So it's an exciting time where I feel like I don't have to convince someone who's 30 that even though I have prosthetic legs, I don't need to play a character who does. I do have to convince someone generally who's in their 60s or older about that.
Wow, that says a lot, doesn't it? We've come a long way. It's never too late to learn this, though. And I love what was the phrase you used? The gift of naivete. I love that.
I think it is a gift. I think it's so beautiful that we're all born with it. I mean, all children think that they can be whoever they want to be until they're repeatedly told that they can't. And I think it's something we really have to fight to hold on to, that you know, remember to lean into yourself. Trust in the vision of who you want to become and know that you can change it as you go along. Reserve the right to change and grow and rewrite as you're going. And that's, I feel like, hopefully, that's what living your life well is.
That's Amy Mullins with our colleague Beth Adams, a conversation with one of the 10 inductees of the 2017 National Women's Hall of Fame class. Amy Mullins, she says at 42, she thought she was way too young for this, and surely she had to be a presenter and not the recipient. Let me ask the co-presidents, Betty Bayer and Eileen Hartman. I mean, I know you've talked to her. You said that she's got a great sense of humor. It's no surprise to hear that remarkable interview with her. But Betty, so much inspiration that comes from that. And my guess is she's still by far not the youngest woman in the Hall of Fame.
That's a good question. I haven't really looked at them in terms of age, but it does seem sometimes that older women are nominated. So I actually really value the fact that she's 42 and in the hall, because I think it sends a different message as well, that the criteria are met by women at all ages. And I think that's a true possibility. I love this interview with her. And one thing I wanted to note was that our inductees also participated in panels over the weekend. So we do a lot to try and educate. So Amy spoke to high school students at Minders Academy with several other inductees. And she told some of the same stories. But what really strikes you is how she is someone who engages your imagination. And she's someone who asks you to rethink the limits of the body and to think about embodiment. And in response to a young girl's question, she said, did I ever feel awkward? Of course, try swimming when your prostheses are two wooden sticks with rubber shoes on the bottom and you're sitting in class and one of them falls apart. She said, you know, there are a lot of things, but her capacity to reimagine prostheses, I think, is just, and the body, I think, is just so powerful.
Mm. Eileen,
I love how she rises to the challenge. She rises to the challenge, and she has the confidence to do that, and maybe doesn't always project her naivete or whatever. She tries to hide it somewhat as she goes along, but she has that confidence to move ahead. And you have to think that probably she had a lot of support from her family as well. I know that during the induction ceremonies, we heard a lot from the inductees about how their mothers especially supported them and encouraged them to move ahead. And I think that support really pushes you ahead. And obviously, it helped her. She's self-motivated, but you have that additional motivation from other people as well.
You can take your family to learn much more about Amy and all of the women, the nearly 300 women in the National Women's Hall of Fame now. Betty Bayer and Eileen Hartman are co-presidents. Check out womenofthehall.org for that list of the 10 inductees. Let's get our only break of the hour. You'll hear from another of the inductees, Temple Grandin. We'll also run down the rest of the list for you if you missed any of the 2017 inductees. And before the hour is out, just want to remind you of what's going to happen that they hope in the very near future. Big changes and developments for the National Women's Hall of Fame. We're broadcasting live from WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, and we're right back with you next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, as we broadcast live from WEOS in Geneva, a conversation about the music and entertainment scene right here in the heart of the Finger Lakes. From the large venues, the Classic, the Smith Center for the Arts, or you might call it the Smith Opera House. They've got a new executive director, and we're going to talk to her. And also a brand new venue called FLX Live, looking for touring national acts smaller to mid-size. How will they do it? We'll talk to them next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Who are The 2017 inductees of the National Women's Hall of Fame. Well, you just heard the amazing Amy Mullins with our colleague Beth Adams. In a moment, you're going to hear Temple Grandin, and I will ask the co-presidents of the National Women's Hall of Fame, Betty Bayer and Eileen Hartman, to tell us a little bit about Temple Grandin before we hear this briefer interview.
Sure, I'm happy to. As Eileen mentioned, we divided the labor on these. What I really loved in reading the articles written by Temple Grandin and her works was the way that she comes back to the fact that she's a visual thinker. And she's a visual thinker who also started to imagine what it's like to learn about the world through your senses. And so while many people are familiar with the fact that she's transformed how we understand autism, she's transformed humane treatment of animals, I really want to come back to that visual thinking and the way that as a young child even, in the way that she would construct kites, build different things, and constantly reimagine and design them. So that's one of the key things for Temple Grandin. And to be fair, some of the work and the writing that she's done and her own research has transformed, I think, the discipline of psychology as well, because it's very rare to have a woman, first off, who's autistic, to bring forward her own research and transform the way that we understand what's been a category of thinking about persons with autistic abilities.
Well, let's listen to Temple Grandin in conversation with our Beth Adams.
Congratulations on your upcoming induction into the Women's Hall of Fame. What does this honor mean to you?
It really means a lot to me. Because when I first started in the 70s, being a woman in a man's industry, in the cattle industry, that was hard. And I had to prove that I could do it. I was really motivated to make sure my stuff was really good and to prove that I wasn't stupid. I've learned sometimes a woman has to be, you know, much better than a man. I've seen men lots of times get away with making mistakes that I'd be in a lot of trouble for if I made them.
You have described your childhood as active and full of discovery as you sought out all kinds of work experience so you could reach your full potential. Were your parents the driving force behind that?
Well, mother was always encouraging my ability in art. And of course, being a child of the 50s, we played outside and we made things. And one of the things that really disturbs me today is children do not play outside. There's a lot of children in my neighborhood. I never see them outside. And during the eclipse, we were at 95% at the university. We were getting these weird eclipse-shaped shadows. And students were just walking over it, not paying any attention to it. They're just too absorbed in electronics. And I had a great childhood. Rode bikes, flying kites, making stuff. A lot of kids today need to be doing a lot more of those sort of things.
What other advice do you have for parents of children who are on the spectrum? I mean, there are so many more resources for kids now than there were for you growing up in the 50s and 60s.
Autism's a big spectrum. It goes from Einstein, who also had no language till age 3, Silicon Valley scientist, to somebody who never learns to talk and may have very serious medical problems on top of the autism. But there's a tendency to overprotect kids. I've seen fully verbal kids that haven't learned shopping. That's something I learned when I was 7. You've got to stretch these kids. You got to stretch them just outside the comfort zone to keep them developing. You don't throw them in the deep end of the pool where they're going to get completely sensory overloaded. But if you don't stretch, then they don't develop. And you need to show them all kinds of interesting things. One of the worst things the schools have done today is taking out all the hands-on classes, cooking, sewing, woodworking, theater, music, art. Also, these classes teach problem solving, and they also introduce kids to a lot of different careers.
Your ability to understand the sensitivities of animals, I think, is just a great example of the advantages of an autistic mind. I mean, your work changed the way much of livestock in this country is handled on their way to slaughter to make it more ethical for them. What other advantages do non-neurotypical people have, do you think?
Well, they certainly have got some social advantages. I'm an extreme visual thinker. So when I design things, I can like test run it in my mind. And when I was young, I didn't know that other people were not visual thinkers. I thought everybody thought in pictures. It's been an interesting journey for me finding out that not everybody thinks in pictures. I discussed this in my book, The Autistic Brain, also in Thinking in Pictures, when I did an update in 2006.
Well, what's keeping you busy these days? What are you working on?
Well, I'm working on a book right now on all kinds of fun projects for kids to do. And when I was a little kid, I experimented with bird kites and with helicopters and with making all kinds of stuff, and I want to get kids back interested in those kinds of things.
That is Temple Grandin, one of the 2017 inductees of the National Women's Hall of Fame. They just had their induction weekend, and Betty and Eileen, the co-presidents of the National Women's Hall of Fame, were saying how interesting it was to watch the interaction and the bonding that took place, and you know, such a diversity of voices and backgrounds here. Mm-hmm. But Betty, tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I noticed at the high school panel that when Amy Mullen started talking about how she first began to envision a different design for prostheses, watching Terminator and wondered why there weren't articulated joints, and then she would be at a wax museum and see the color of the flesh and so on. You could see Temple Grandin become very engaged in, and I saw the two of them talking a lot about design and working out design. And, you know, so there's a way in which our inductees start to build their own sort of connections to one another. On Sunday at Wesleyan Chapel, Sherry Lansing, Amy Mullins, and Carol Mutter were on the panel on second acts or philanthropy, women's advocacy. And Sherry Lansing made that very comment, that she said she only knew maybe one other person before she, of the 10 inductees, she knew is a friend of Victoria Jackson's. But she said that she felt now that she had this whole expanded world. So I think that's one of the things that we don't often talk about, is how the inductees also value connecting to other women.
womenofthehall.org. It's open 7 days a week for you to tour and take a look. And what we're going to do now is we're going to go over the other 8 names, and we have to do it in very short blurbs. But again, you can see a lot more when you get online at womenofthehall.org or go there in person. So each of our guests has their own sort of focus on these. I'm just going to mention the name, and Eileen and Betty are going to jump in and tell us just a little bit about it. The Honorable Matilda Raffa Cuomo.
Oh my gosh, advocate, mentor. She's still going strong as a mentor, and she's expanded her mentoring program to include anti-bullying and LGBTQ work, and also adopted families.
All right, Lorraine Hansberry.
Essayist, playwright, civil rights activist. Many people don't realize that she was part of the Black intellectual movement, and that included the women's Black intellectual movement. She tackled questions on gender, was a student in W.E.B. Du Bois's class, worked with Langston Hughes. So you have to think about the broad history of Black intellectual life with her.
Victoria Jackson.
Well, entrepreneur, philanthropist, but really I want to focus on, most people know her for her cosmetics, but she is heading up an international research team and transforming the paradigm for that. She's a paradigm shifter. She has over 50 scientists who get together from all over the globe. She goes into the labs with them. She's taking classes, and she really is seeking for them to collaborate on findings and to share those findings to change the course of autoimmune disease research.
Yeah, just reading in your bios that it was when her daughter was diagnosed with the rare autoimmune disease neuromyelitis optica that
yes.
She decided to shift that focus.
Yes, and she actually went and took classes. So, you know, these are women who don't just say, oh, I'm going to jump in and lend a hand. She started taking classes so she could understand the terminology. She goes right into the labs.
Sherry Lansing.
Sherry Lansing, wow, okay. CEO and president of, and the first woman, president of 20th Century Fox. Then she became an independent film producer for a few years, Jeff Lansing Productions, and then head of Paramount Pictures for over 13 years. So she broke several glass ceilings. We'll know her for films such as Titanic, Forrest Gump, and also signature films, The China Syndrome, The Accused, and Fatal Attraction, which had its 30th anniversary this year.
All right, that's Sherry Lansing. So Claire Booth Luce, is it Luce?
Luce.
Okay, Claire Booth Luce.
Claire Booth Luce. When I think about her, I think about creativity. Her parents were both from very creative backgrounds. She was a journalist during World War II. She wrote several plays, including a very successful one on Broadway called The Women. She was elected to Congress and reelected. She was a supporter of equal pay for equal work. She was an ambassador to Italy. And then a most interesting turn, she decided when she passed in her will that she would support women in STEM careers. Now, she had not herself ever been in STEM, but knew the value of putting the money behind other women to support them in those fields.
Okay. Carol Mutter.
Carol Mutter is a lieutenant, now retired, a lieutenant general in the Marine Corps. She, in high school, was dedicated to becoming a math teacher, went to what I called a summer camp, but she said was definitely not a summer camp in the Marine Corps. And she learned that, indeed, that was the career that she wanted to pursue. She used her math skills throughout. She was in finance. She was involved in the space as a space commander while she was in the Marines. And today, she's still working as a consultant for all that she was able to do in the Marines and from her own natural abilities, of course.
The first woman Marine three-star general, I'm reading.
Yes, wow. Exactly.
Dr. Janet Rowley.
Fascinating woman. She went to the University of Chicago, as did both of her parents, stayed connected to the University of Chicago throughout her academic career, earned her medical degree there, met her husband, who was also a medical student there, and then discovered that she could connect the cancer to heredity, in other words, cancer would remain within families. Okay, so she was a geneticist and a discoverer through her entire life. And by the way, I loved listening to her grandchildren who came to accept the award for her. They were so enthusiastic and so involved still with the University of Chicago.
So she's the reason we know cancer is genetic. Amazing.
Exactly.
Alice Waters.
Alice Waters from the get-go when she went abroad to London and got into Montessori education and her connection to children, and then went to France and discovered the joy of food that was available, the fresh food that was there, and then brought that back to Berkeley, California, where she opened Chez Panisse restaurant, which was at that time unorthodox. And it was all fresh food. She connected to the farmers and continues through her whole life to let us all understand how important the land is, how the environment is important, and how that all connects to how healthy we are. And I think many of us have picked up, of course, on what it is that she was trying to convey way before we understood it all.
In fact, some of the leading chefs in our Finger Lakes region happen to be women, and more than one, including the late Deborah Whiting from Red Newt Bistro, told me that they were inspired personally by Alice Waters, and that there might not be a real, authentic local food movement that's not a fad, that's not a trend, that is a real ethos and spirit of communities without Alice Waters. An amazing story.
Exactly.
So look at this. There's your 10 inductees, womenofthehall.org. And in our last 90 seconds or so, I want you to know what they are trying to do. So Betty, what do you want the community to know about where you're going next and what you need from the community?
Thank you, Evan, and thanks for this time. I would really invite people to go to our website and to look at the project of the mill. The wonderful news is that we've outgrown our current space. The second bit of good news is that the Women's Hall of Fame is rehabilitating the 1844 Seneca Knitting Mill. We've stabilized the exterior. We've stabilized the building. We're ready to do all the interior work, and now we need people's help. We're into our campaign, and we're inviting people to talk to us. You can email us at the hall, phone us. There are lots of opportunities to have your name on parts of the building, to find a way to donate monthly. This new building is going to not just give us more space, but more opportunities so that we will have an area for education and conferences so that we can bring people in to really start to talk about leadership and run leadership workshops. And we hope that more of our inductees will be able to be there to do that as well. We also need to house the archives and have more space for people to donate their artifacts, their papers, and so on. So it's an exciting project. The building is gracious and majestic, this limestone building beside the Erie Canal. It's actually breathtaking.
And if people want to contribute, they can jump online, learn more
jump
how to do it.
Jump online now. Yes, www.womenofthehall.org.
Betty Bayer has told us, and both Betty and Eileen reminding us, that when you look nationally, U.S. history books continue to fall below 10% in terms of reference to women. When it comes to national landmarks, monuments, Fewer than 5% of more than 2,400 include women in women's history. So that's why, to any cynics who have that those kind of sentiments, they feel there's as strong a need as ever. And I just want to thank Eileen and Betty for being here and sharing these stories. Thank you. We'll see you at the hall.
We'll see you at the hall. Thank you so much.
7 days a week if you'd like to go to the hall.
Thanks,
Short break,
Evan.
And we continue broadcasting live from our WEOS studios at Finger Lakes Public Radio in Geneva.